It's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Mark. I haven't seen him since we were in Prague together in July. And of course, we ran two wonderful trips this summer to Spain. And the first one and then the second one to Central Europe, but Budapest, Vienna, Bratislava, Prague. And we're working on their trips, please God, for next summer. We'll keep you posted. And when we'll let you know when we have all the details. Okay. With that, it's a pleasure. Welcome back, Dr. Mark, to continue. I imagine we'll start at a new point for those.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Identify yourself.
And I'll just say, though, we might even have something in the winter. We'll see. Still being worked out.
Correct.
We've done 11 classes on the Musar dispute, and now we're picking up with class number 12. We're about more than two-thirds of the way, almost closer to three-quarters of the way done the Katz book. I do want to just begin right where we left off, but two quick comments. Moshe from Lakewood emailed me that he saw in this book, which he didn't have access to, but he remembered it, a book by the guy, Nan's name, it's spelled Gibraltar. I don't know if in Russia they said Gibraltar. I don't know, and I don't know why he has that name. But he's not a Sephardi, I mean, the Jews only came to Gibraltar a few hundred years ago from Morocco. But be that as it may, so what you have in this book, it's by Yitzchak Gibraltar, Yasor Yisraeli, on page 78, it says something very interesting that Rav Yisrael, it became popular in the Musar movement to give people the fifth aliyah. That was considered the Kavodik aliyah. Now, where do you get the fifth aliyah? We know it's the sixth aliyah. If you're not a chassid, if you're a chassid, it's a sixth aliyah. If you're a non-chassid, it's the third aliyah. In fact, the old joke is every week at the seminary, Lieberman would give Heschel the sixth aliyah, and Lieberman commented that he thinks that's the most important aliyah. In other words, we know it's not, and if you know Lieberman's view of Heschel, so each of them were satisfied. Actually, Galila is considered the most important, but it's not. It seems. Moshe pointed out to me in the Divrei Yirmiyah Perush, when they say Galila, they mean what we call Hagba Galila, not what we do Ashkenazim, where you have one guy lifted and the other guy wrapped. It means, I guess, with a tik or however it is, but it means one person. So then the question is, what's going on now? How is it the fifth Aliyah? So what it says in this book is as follows, that Rav Yisrael Salanter, you know, everyone wanted to give him an aliyah. So he said that he wanted once he was called up, they want to call him up. And he says he doesn't want the third aliyah. Certainly in Lithuania, no one will get the sixth if you're a big rabbi. He says, give me the fifth. Now, why does he say, give me the fifth? I think it's obvious that Rishon Salanter Dafka wanted the least important, because we've spoken about what a tzaddik is and an unav. He didn't walk around with airs and gabayim and all that. If the fifth aliyah is the least important, that's the one he wants, and give everyone else aliyahs that they think are important. Because he chose the least important aliyah, that then becomes the most important one for his followers, because that's the one Rav Salanter did. If Rav Salanter said he wants the seventh aliyah, that would have been the most important aliyah as well. Okay, and one more thing. I've made two mistakes on this, so this time I'm getting it right. Thank you to Rabbi Isaac Rice for pointing this out about the milk issue and Rav Hirschel Schechter. The first time I implied, I don't know if I meant to, but I think I implied that, or maybe even said, that this wouldn't be an issue with Chalvi Stroll. And then I described it as that they do something to the cows that creates the trefus. That is wrong as well. Both times I simply was relying what I was told. Now I've actually looked it up, and thank you, Rabbi Rice. It's a simple matter that with cows, the majority of, not the majority, but about 30 or 40% of cows, it turns out that they have trefus. So if you look at all the cows, it's not like we have one cow which we know is a good cow. All the milk is mixed together. So therefore, any bottle of milk you buy is taking milk from 30%, let's say, of the cows that they're trefos, so it's not bato b'shishim, because let's say it's 30%. So therefore, if Schechter holds that all cow milk, Chol Yisrael, not Chol Yisrael, simply because that if you look at our cows, there's a huge percentage of them which would be regarded as trefos. And of that, there's no doubt. And that's why he says, he doesn't say, he himself doesn't eat, drink the milk. But all the other Gedolim that I know of, Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Rav Yosef, I believe, all have said it's not an issue. We don't concern ourselves with this statistic in outer space. We just look at the cows we have in front of us, and each individual cow, you don't know if it's a problem. And therefore, let's put it this way, we don't have to give up milk yet, because it's not just milk, it would be everything, ice cream and chocolate and everything. So, Rabbi Rice, if I still got it not exactly right, you let me know. And Rabbi Rice has I haven't listened to it yet, hope to in the car, but on Why You Torah, he has a class on this. We'll explain in more details. Ruth, you can't see any trefos in a living cow. What happens is after they slaughter cows, then they find this. So these are the same cows that in a different farm are giving milk. So therefore, then you can make the assumption that a large percentage of cows have problems, larger than, let's say, points six, larger than one out of 60. They say it's more like one out of three. So that's the issue, in short. You say milk cows are not used for meat in our day. All I can say is that no, they say that milk cows, when they slaughter them, not to eat them, but whatever, if they get old, whatever they do. I'm just reading what I found after Rabbi Rice pointed out to me. But we'll leave it at that. Okay, so we're now on in Pumus HaMusar. We're in chapter 13, which we're not going to do. I'm not going to summarize it, because this whole chapter, a very large chapter, I'll just make one or two points, is called the Vikuach Bein HaSofrim. That is, Katz has a whole chapter on the Haskalah writers and how they got involved in this dispute, because many of them were very anti-traditional, and the fact that the yeshivas were being... As far as the fact that these new yeshivas were being attacked, they liked it. They liked controversy. Others authentically thought that the Musar yeshivas were a problem, and others were great defenders of the Musar yeshivas. So they said at the very beginning of the course, I want to focus on the Gedol Yisrael, the rabbis, but anyone interested, you can read all. He has back and forth the dispute. The only thing I'll note is Berdyshevsky. Berdyshevsky, a chaver of Rav Kook from the days in Volozhin, becomes the arch apikores, the Nietzschean Berdyshevsky, although Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was quite taken by his writing. He even has an essay on him. He says that the heresy of Berdyshevsky is a sort of heresy. It's not just a heresy from Taivas or anything like that. It's a heresy of a real thinker. And he's a heretic because, basically saying he's a heretic because we haven't presented him with a Judaism at his level. That sort of, Rav Kook says very similar things, incidentally. So Berdyshevsky is a fascinating person. His father's a Rav, his Volozhin student, and his first articles are very traditional. But then he becomes obviously completely overturning, transvaluation of values, overturning anything in traditional Judaism. But he actually was a defender of the Musar yeshivas, and I don't think it's he's a very authentic person. He isn't trying to create trouble or anything like that. Katz quotes what he says, that these rabbis who opposed the Musar movement forgot that Moshe Rabbeinu is said to have also written Sefer Iyov. Leaving aside the historical aspect of it, but I mean, the Gemara man has such an opinion. So what does that show you? That it's not only about traditional Torah study and Gemara. Moshe Rabbeinu, who gave us the Torah, has also wrote a work, it says, that of theology. So that shows that you need more, or that matters other than traditional Torah study are also important. And then he talks about how not everyone is suited just to learn Gemara, Shas, and Poskim. What he says is something that we would find very appealing, I think, almost everyone. He says that not everyone can focus on of just shas and poskim. There needs to be room for other elements, and spirituality has to find itself in other ways as well. He says that that and all these attacks are not hurting them. On the contrary, it's giving them strength, etc., etc. So quite interesting, Berdyshevsky. He moved, so that's chapter 13. Move on from that. The next chapter, he basically is coming to the end of the book, and he calls the chapter Kolot Mipo Misham. Just he's throwing everything in here, everything which he couldn't fit in earlier chapters. For example, on page 231, he quotes Meir Bar-Ilan, and Meir Bar-Ilan wrote a memoir. He wrote a memoir, Mivolozhin Ad Yerushalayim. He's the son of the Netziv. He's the brother of Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin, I think it's he's 40, you have to check it. I think he's 47 years older than his younger brother, a Meir Berlin. Meir comes Bar Ilan. That's because the Netziv remarries. The first wife is the famous Reina Batya, who's become famous because of the story of Rav Baruch Epstein, the Torah Tamima in his Makor Baruch, which I've argued is a fabrication. Not to say that this white Reina Batya was not a very interesting person, but the whole story he invents about her wanting to study Torah and complaining about how terrible it is the way the rabbis treat women, all that stuff. My point is, my argument is that's Reb Baruch Epstein, his ideology, putting it in the mouth I don't know what you even call it, his aunt, right? Putting it in her mouth. But not correct. I don't believe it's correct. Is his aunt? No, it's his. Well, then his second wife. I forget now. Because I forget now. Yeah, Aruch
Married his
HaShulchan
niece.
married. Netziv married his sister for the second wife, right? I think it's his aunt. No, but but I think that Netziv becomes his. I forget now. I have to check it. I'm confused.
Mark, if I
But
remember correctly, if I can interject, Jeff, for a second, if I remember
yeah.
correctly, he married his niece, and his father-in-law, his brother-in-law became his father-in-law.
His brother-in-law
But
became his
the Aruch
father-in-law. Yeah, I get
HaShulchan,
confused with all.
and then he married the daughter, so his brother-in-law became his father-in-law, and there was a 36-year age gap. He was like 70, 71. I think he had Meir Bar-Ilan, he was like 72 years old. And Rav Chaim Berlin, he got married like at 16 the first time. So there's a like a
I get
six,
confused with all these.
right, but that's story.
It might have been I think it was 16 or 14. I forget now. I have to check that it's saved. I very early. Okay, so that's and he re records about the Musar dispute and Nevardic and everything. But what's really interesting, I think, is that he mentions his maternal grandfather. His maternal grandfather is oh, that's right. So what Rabbi Kalman just said, his maternal grandfather is the Aruch HaShulchan, Michael Epstein of Nevardic. And if you recall from last semester, we spoke of Rav Borstein of Tavur, Gavron Borstein, who said crazy stuff against the Musar movement. And the Aruch HaShulchan attacked him as also with using language that you never would use if you knew the person. I mean, today people attack others on the internet because they don't know them. In the days of the rabbis, 150 years ago, they would attack each other sometimes because they didn't know each other personally. What he says, which I find fascinating, because he says it about his grandfather. And usually you defend your families, but he says that he says, first of all, Nevardic, as we know, that's where Rav Yosef Yoizel was in his town. But then he says that Letzarenu, he says, unfortunately, my grandfather was basically says he was misled by Rav Yoizel because he saw him as like some perfect person. And he didn't know who Rav Borstein was, who was a great Gaon, and he publicized things against him which were completely incorrect. So how often do you find a grandson saying about a grandfather that the grandfather said things which were incorrect because he was misled on the one hand to defend someone and to attack another great rabbi because of he didn't know him. So that's he says that my grandfather was among those sort of people that when they make a decision, The first they don't sit on it basically. As soon as they come to a conclusion, they do something. And then he didn't. He's saying my grandfather didn't consider this matter the results of it, of using such as he calls it Dibor Harif, and he just went ahead and and attacked the Rabborstein. Okay, interesting. Then he continues on, and now it's going to start to get really interesting. With because we're going to see Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg and the Rav of Soloveitchik, because the Rav, for some reason, decided to put his foot in the ring on this matter, and we'll get to that in a second. But he begins page 36 and on with Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg. We've spoken so much about Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg. Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg wrote the first academic essays on the Mussar movement in Hebrew. There was one or two in German, but he's the first one in Hebrew, and you can find these in the Sridi Yeish. And he isn't just an outsider. He's part of the Mussar movement. He's a Talmud Mufak of the Alter of Sabotka and very close to Tali Amsterdam and Rabbi Yitzhak Blaser, two of the three great students of Yisrael Salanter. Although he's a partisan of Musser, he also writes the first article about the Musser dispute. So he's very important. And he summarizes things I already mentioned. Let me just a couple of things that I haven't mentioned yet. Rabbi Weinberg speaks about why were there maskilim who supported Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. That's a fact. There were maskilim who were very much on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's side before the Mussar movement really expands, the first generation. And Rabbi Weinberg points out that these Maskilim would later become enemies of the Mussar movement, also of the Yisrael Salanter, but only after his lifetime, not in his lifetime. But they thought that here you have someone. Well, what did the Maskilim wanted? They wanted to regeneration of traditional Judaism. They wanted a reevaluation of what was important, change of values, instead of the focus on only on Talmud study, the focus on other things as well. They saw Rabbi Yisrael Salanter as perhaps the person who was going to lead to this revolution in Jewish thought. So much so that they actually asked him if he would take over the rabbinical seminary in Vilna. The rabbinical seminary, these were seminaries, one in Vilna and one in Zhytomyr, that were established by the Tsarist government in line with the Maskilim to try to create a new type of Jew and indoctrinate the rabbis into modern values. And they thought that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter might actually want to be involved with that. Of course, he didn't. He turned him down and he even left the city because he didn't want to be stuck in that situation. But they thought, here you have a person, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who's speaking about matters that the regular rabbis weren't speaking about. He's not just speaking about, let's say, ritual obligations. He's speaking about ethics and not just the commandments to use the Chovos HaLevavos terms of our body, but also the commandments of our heart. And they thought that this was someone who could be a leader, create a new type of Judaism. Because remember, we're not talking about the Maskilim in Galicia. We're talking about in Lithuania, many of whom were still religious. They just, today we call them modern Orthodox. And some of them, to this day, we study their writings. Even the Rabbi Matisyahu Strashun, whose notes are in the Vilna Shas, absolutely. And even his father, by the way, the famous Rashash, has to be put in this category, and many other figures, Rashi Finn. You can go down the list. They're good Torah Umada, Torim Derech Eretz type of Jews. As Rabbi Weinberg points out, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was calling for a Techiyah Ruchanit, really a spiritual regeneration, and they thought that he was going to be a revolutionary, a religious revolutionary, when Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wasn't trying to revolutionize Judaism in the way they wanted. He just wanted to bring back those matters that had been forgotten, as it were, or had been pushed to the side, but things which he believed were part of traditional Judaism. So Rabbi Weinberg says that the Maskilim Tau Taurus Gemura, they made an absolute mistake because Lo Yardu L'Sof Da'ato. Because he wasn't interested in removing a stress from being medakdeik in mitzvot. No, he didn't want to take away anything from Judaism. He just wanted to broaden what Judaism is. That's very different than the Maskilim, who wanted to remove a good deal. Even though Even the ones I'm speaking about who were religious, they didn't believe in that, that Talmud study should be such a focus. They wanted to study Tanakh and history, which, by the way, was also the ideology of the modern Orthodox rabbis as well, that unless you're going to be trained to be a Dayan, you need to expose yourself in other matters. So the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, Yeshiva University, has a much had a much broader curriculum. So that's what he quotes Rabbi Yechiyahu of Weinberg as teaching. One more thing he mentions from Rabbi Weinberg is, yes, this is Rabbi Weinberg is the first one to say it, but then it becomes a myth of the yeshiva world that in Rabbi Weinberg's discussion of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and the Musar movement, he's the first one to say that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter anticipate precedes Freud in uncovering and discovering the unconscious, the subconscious. And he talks a little bit about this. Now, this then becomes, like I said, the legend in the yeshiva world. Just one more thing you can add to the Rav Yisrael Salanter's greatness, that something that the olam, the world, sees as so important, in the yeshiva world, when you deal with the outside world, it often is either it's meaningless, it's useless, or mevatalet, or if it really is important, you want to show that we anticipated it. So one of the things that we anticipated it is that the unconscious, Freud. Now, Etkes in his book on Salanter shows that this is not the case, that Rousseau Salanter, what he meant by what he spoke about was very different than what Freud's speaking about. But this then becomes, this is one of the great myths. I don't know today because people don't know that much about Musar, but that became a great myth. And as far as I can tell, Rabbi Weinberg is the first one in print to mention this. I'm not saying that he invented this idea. It probably was being passed around others as well, but he's the first one in print, although who, as far as I know, although Katz says that he also mentions this as well, but I believe Rabbi Weinberg is earlier than him. He says, Rousseau Salanter, hikdim et Freud begilui hashita ha'madait bedavar chaya nefesh mitachat l'safa hakara. Okay, very nice. Then let's okay, and then he this is a relevance to what we've been doing about the Musar movement because he summarizes the dispute. He summarizes Rabbi Weinberg. After going through, he has many essays. You can see him in Sridi Yesh, essays on the Musar movement, essays on the leading figures of the Musar movement. He records drashot of the Alter Slabodka. The Alter Slabodka was famous for his very important drashos that they published. And then, after all this discussion, he says, we have to be honest. We can't cover up. We have to mention that there was great dispute and that there were great rabbis who persecuted the Musarniks, just like the Misnagdim persecuted the Hasidim. They were rodef after them. They tried to chase them out. They didn't want their yeshivas there. All the stuff we spoke about. So Rabbi Weinberg says this obviously today would appear very strange, but why did they? And he has a good summary. We've dealt with, I think, all these issues. But let me just quickly summarize it. He says their fear was that Musar would push aside the Torah. That is, instead of learning Gemara, they focus on Musar. That many people put a great emphasis on the study of Musar, so that it's not just that time, the time they spent on it took away from Talmud Torah in a traditional sense, but also what was considered valuable. And we know that in Slabodka, for instance, yes, if you're a Talmudic scholar, you're praise, but also you didn't, even if you weren't such a great Lamdin, but if you're good in Musar, you also were put on a pedestal. Then he mentions the fear that the Musarniks were creating a cut, a special sect that is not intended for everyone. It's an elitist organization, which they didn't like. Then he mentions the fear that if you focus on what's wrong with you, going into great detail about tikkun midot, trying to create is, make your characteristics, improve them, that's going to lead to a that's not healthy, and that's going to first of all, you won't have time to do anything else, but it's going to be it's problematic to look at all the all of your problems. That's no good. And he goes on and on and on. Now he mentions that and he's the only first person, I believe, to mention this, the only person that Rav Shmuel Salant also from Sawant, he asked the following question to Rishul Sawant. He said to him, Rishul Sawant later becomes the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, how you, Yisrael Salanter, can go around saying that everyone should learn Musar when previous generations did not? And Rishul Salanter's answer, we're going to come back to it with Rishul Soloveitchik in a couple of minutes, but Rishul Salanter said that previous generations were not sick, so therefore they didn't need the medicine, namely Musar. He says, we, hinenu cholim, we are sick, and we only have one way to cure ourselves, and that's through Musar. So if you ask me why previous generations didn't have this focus, that where they sit and study this, it's because they didn't need it. Now, Rabbi Weinberg says, I don't know if people would accept this, but he says this. He thinks that what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said was not Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's real view. Now, understand what Rabbi Weinberg's saying. He's saying that when, I mean, Yisrael Salanter is the greatest ethical specimen we know. I mean, if you read the stories about him, and if even only, one out of 10 of the stories are true, and by the way, these stories are stated by eyewitnesses, students, and we're not dealing with Maisios of Hasidim. So it's most of them are certainly true, in my opinion. He is a specimen of an ethical specimen. Like it's hard to see another example of his greatness. I mean, he's and yet Rabbi Weinberg says that he wasn't telling the truth when he spoke to Shmuel Salant. So I guess the lesson is that even great people, ethical or ethical superiors like Rishul Salant, if they feel it's necessary, they can Mishana Esa-Emes, they can twist the truth. Mipnei Hashalom. The Gemara says you're allowed to lie for Shalom. So, what is so Rabbi Weinberg says? I think that he only said this to Rishul Salant to basically to make Rishul Salant to pacify Rishul Salant. Rishul Salant's all upset. What are you studying? Why are you saying everyone else to do Musar? And he says, well, because we're sick. I'm not casting judgment on previous generations. He says he only did this Lafistato, show Rishul Salant, Ponim was a canim Shaldoras HaKodmim. Why does Rabbi Weinberg said this? Because in Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's letters to his students and his teachings, he says that Musar is an obligation on everyone. This includes the greatest rabbis. It's Musar. You can't imagine Judaism properly without Musar. So this is something that was done in every generation, or and if it wasn't done, it should have been done. He doesn't accept, Rabbi Weinberg does not accept this idea that because we're at a low level, we have to. That would imply that the great rabbis don't have to. But the answer is no. Everyone needs to study Musar. Not only that, he goes on because it includes all aspects of life, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone has to focus. A Talmud Chacham, an Am Haaretz, Me'isha Ad Isha. Even women need to study Musar. This is in an era when most women didn't study anything. So what does that mean? It's, well, there's women texts of Musar as well. They could be in Yiddish. Everyone needs to focus on this. And for all time, everyone needs to focus on this. And what about, Rabbi Weinberg says, the opponents of Musar said that if you're involved with Musar, it's going to be Bittul Torah and everything. Rabbi Weinberg says, and I mentioned this already, that we see this is not true. Empirically, it's not true. Look at the Musar yeshivas, and you see Dafka. He says Dafka in the Musar yeshivas, Torah study reached its heights, and it's definitely true. I'm not going to go as far as Ari Weinberg and say that the Musar yeshivas, the learning Gemara, was better than the other yeshivas, but certainly it was their equal. You take Sobotka, and I'm Sobotka as we know it, the traditional Sobotka, the Sobotka of Yaakov Chamanetzky and Rav Ruderman and Shaul Lieberman and Rabbi Weinberg, etc. You're going to tell me that Knesset Beis Yitzchak, the other Musar yeshiva, and the other, sorry, yeshiva in Sobotka, the non-Musar yeshiva, which later became known as Kamenetz, that the people from there are greater. If you look at the list, more of the great Gedolim in Gemara learning come out of the Musar yeshiva, come out of Sobotka than the non-Musar Sobotka. So we see that, and the koach of the chiddush of the students in all areas of Torah reached enormous heights. So just empirically, you cannot say that you spend a half hour, an hour a day learning Musar, that that's that's going to affect you negatively. There's an old joke which maybe is relevant to this, when someone says they I don't know if this is a true story or an apocryphal story, a Bala bus only had like a half hour a day to learn. He's very busy. So he asked for Resource Salanter, should I learn? Because Resource Salanter said everyone has to learn Musar, even the Bala bus, even the layperson. So he asked for Resource Salanter, I only have a half hour, an hour, whatever the number he gave was. He says, should I learn Halacha or Gemara, whatever he said, or Musar? And Rabbi Saul Saunter's answer was, learn Musar, and then you'll see you have more than a half hour. So Musar has to go before everything, and then you'll see you have more time. And then Rabbi Weinberg says, and what about this accusation that we've seen that it's going to create a cult, a sect? He says, this is a warped view. Rabbi Weinberg says there's a difference between a sect and a group. Kat and a chevra. And what's the definition of a kat, a sect? He says, from a Jewish perspective, it means giving up the mitzvos and the minhagim, which are accepted by the rest of the Jewish community. So if you create a sect and you start doing things differently than everyone else, even if you observe mitzvos, but you do it differently and you don't, you have your own way of doing things, that would be a sect. But a chevra, as he says, doesn't separate from the community, doesn't separate from the Mesorah. It's just an organization of people who come together for a specific purpose, in this case, to raise themselves spiritually, ethically, etc. And therefore, it's not a cut at all. And finally, he says, and this is how Rabbi Weinberg concludes, it's on 250 in Katz. The machlokes against Musar ended with the victory of the Baalei Musar. And that's an absolute fact. The Musar, in accordance with the Rishos Salanter, entered into all the yeshivas in Israel and in the diaspora without any complaints. He's saying eventually. And everyone sees that it's really a fortress for Judaism and the spirit of Judaism. Now, he's almost correct that it entered everywhere. It didn't enter everywhere, obviously. It didn't enter all the Sephardic yeshivas. And even the Ashkenazic yeshivas, we'll see a couple of them that at least it took a while. But even those places, it entered. So maybe, I guess he is correct that all the Ashkenazic yeshivas. I want to now mention something that he mentions it. What's his name? Katz mentions on 256, he speaks about the famous, he quotes from Rabbi Soloveitchik, the story of Volozhin and Reb Chaim. First, he says that there was, actually, before we get to that, he says that he talks about how in the early generations they tried to get Musar into the yeshivas, and they were not at first completely successful. They came to the Netziv, and in fact, he quotes here that that Rabbi Shlomo came to the Netziv and wanted. He said, "I'll be the Mashgiach in the yeshiva," and Rabbi, the Netziv said, "No, we can't do this." He says that if you, Rabbi Shlomo, become the Mashgiach, then what am I supposed to do? You'll be the But and then we're and what about, and he mentions that they tried to get Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to put Musar. So that's the famous story of the Rav. I'll get to that in a second. And then he quotes here on page 256 how Musar get coming into the Mir Yeshiva. At first they pushed it off. In fact, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, who was also the Rav of Mir, Eliyahu Baruch Kamai, he originally did not allow Musar in the yeshiva because he doesn't know what this Musar thing is. He says, he quotes him as saying, once he took the Mesilas Yesharim and he went through it. And then he says, I don't understand why yeshiva students spend so much time learning Mesilas Yesharim. In other words, Rabbi Kamai said, I read it. I read it. Okay, I read it. Well, I'm going to read it again and again and again. In other words, he didn't have a taste for it. It wasn't for him. His son, Rabbi Eliyahu Baruch Kamai, Eliyahu Baruch Kamai is the one who brought Rabbi Chiya of Weinberg. Well, he knew Rabbi Chaya Weinberg as a child, and because he was the Rav of, he came into Chechanovich, and there's a famous story that him and Rabbi Weinberg, and later Rabbi Weinberg, went to his yeshiva, and he went with the Mir Yeshiva. He went with, and it's the Alter Sobaka's son, Rav Eliezer Finkel, and they did go there, and they established Musar, because by then Rav Eliyahu Baruch Kamai had seen what the revolutionary movements had done, and he wanted Musar. His son was Rav Avraham Tzvi Hirsch Kamai. There were two Rashi Yeshiva, the Mir, Rav Eliezer Finkel and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kamai. Rav Eliezer Finkel leaves. He takes the yeshiva. And you can listen to the four classes I did on the rescue of the Mir Yeshiva. But his co-Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kamai, was also the Rav of Mir. And he had to stay with his flock. And he is murdered. And we have very little of his writing. I was fortunate. I published one responsum of his in the collected writings of Rabbi Weinberg. And we only have a very few pieces of his because everything was lost. Then he goes on page 256 that there were other yeshivas that didn't agree to allow the Musarniks in, and he meant at, and he mentions one of them. He mentions, by the way, I think I mentioned this already, Nevardik. In Nevardik, Rav Menachem Krakovsky, the Avodas HaMelech, the uncle of Rav Soloveitchik, the son-in-law of Rav Elia Feinstein, he becomes Rav in Nevardik, and after the Aruch HaShulchan. And he opens a new yeshiva in opposition to the yeshiva of Yosef Yoisel Horovitz, and no Musar there. He mentions other places that didn't have never accepted Musar, the Kollel in Kovno, Kollel Avreichim, when they got rid of, they kicked out Yitzhak Blazer. Then it came under the control of the Rav of Kovno of Ritzir Binowitz, the son of Rav Yitzhak Inspector, and no Musar. But these were short-lived because by the early 20th century, as we'll see, Musar really is in every yeshiva. Now he also says, he acknowledges Katz on page 257. He says we can't deny that even among the yeshivas there were students, even great Torah students, who led the battle against Musar. Wait till you see who led the battle entails. And there were great rabbis who taught at these yeshivas who also led the battles. But okay. But before I move on in here, I want to return to Musar in Volozhin, because that's where you get, some of you might know this from Rav Soloveitchik, the way he tells the story. Now, we have the book Ish Halacha, Rav Soloveitchik's famous essay that appears in the 40s in Talpiot, and then is published a few times later in various volumes. Then it appears in 1983 in a translation by Lawrence Kaplan, published by Jewish Publication Society. And in 2023, on the 40th anniversary, this volume came out, Halacha Kman. If you know the original, how thin it is, look how thick this is, because this has in it. It has the translator's annotations and the introduction, a very long introduction, and annotations. Now, Lawrence Kaplan's maybe the world's expert on the Rav's philosophy. I mean, you have other experts, Dov Schwartz. So here you have the new edition, which has the notes, and it has the famous story that the Rav mentioned. It doesn't appear elsewhere. The Rav is the one to mention it. Obviously, it comes from his father, from his grandfather, and I'll read it to you. And a lot has been written on this, and then we'll see what Rabbi Weinberg has to say about this story. Okay, on page 74, see, the Rav is speaking about what halachic man is. And he talks about that, halachic man is not afraid of death. If you can turn it, if you can, I mean, if you just look at it as most people do, then you're afraid of it. But he says, Reb Chaim, he would study, when he was afraid of death, he would study the laws of Tumah and Tara. And then all of a sudden, it's you're not afraid anymore. On the contrary, now you have joy because you're studying Torah. So halachic man, it's all about triumphing over sadness and being morose and all these things. So he describes, he has a whole three pages about this and how Halachic man is how Halachic man is removed from all this to find a life of in which he moves beyond melancholy. That's right. That's the word he uses. And then he says, so it appears to me that this is the primary factor in why halachic men such as Reb Chaim and the Netziv of Volozhin didn't admit Mussar into the Yeshiva of Volozhin. He says that the Mussar movement, which has an emotion of fear, a sense of lowliness, melancholy, self-negation, constant self-appraisal, the consciousness of sin, self-lacerating torments, etc., constitute the primary features of the movement's spiritual profile in its early years. That's early Mussar. It's definitely Nevardic, and he's saying that that's also Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And it was, he says, it was the practice in Kovno and Sobotka to spend the twilight hour when Shabbos was drawing to a close in an atmosphere suffused with sadness and grief. An atmosphere in which man loses his spiritual shield. He says that. Okay, so that he says that his sense of power, confidence, and strength, and he becomes utterly sensitive and responsive, and there to engage in a monologue about death, the nihility of this world, its emptiness and ugliness. And he says that the Halachic man of Brisk and Volozhin sense that this whole mood posed a profound contradiction to the Halacha. And would undermine its foundations because Halach man fears nothing. He doesn't need to sit there and be melancholy and sit there in sadness and grief. Now, this is a problematic statement of the Rav because he isn't just saying in Kovno, he's saying Slobodka. And we're going to see he contradicts himself in a second. And I have no evidence that Slobodka ever did anything like the Rav describes. Yes, they did this in, let's say, in the Mussar houses they set up. You were, and they did this in Nevardik and others. And but in Slobodka, this is a problem. He says that the halachic man of Brisk and Volozhin, they what do? They swim in the sea of the Talmud, and that's life-giving sea to all the living. What do if you sin? Do you sit there and? Go over in your mind how terrible you are, and it's no. You learn the halachas of tshuva, and you do tshuva. You don't waste time on spiritual self-appraisal, on probing introspections, on picking away at the sense of sin. So he's saying that for halachic man, the whole idea, and you can see they have drashos in the Mussar teachers to analyze what is sin about our personality. No, that's all removing you from where your focus should be. Such a psychic analysis brings man neither to fear nor love of God, nor to the knowledge of cognition of the Torah. The Torah cannot be acquired in a state of melancholy and depression. And the Rav goes on and on, and he says, Reb Chaim replied to Reb Yitzchak Blazer when Reb Yitzchak Blazer came and said to him that you should introduce Mussar. He says, and the Rav says that his response is well known. He says that a man. What did Reb Blazer say? The Gemara says you should always incite the good impulse to fight against the evil impulse. And it says, if you subdue it, good. But if you can't subdue it, study the Torah. And if you subdue it, good. If not, remind yourselves of the day of death. So here the Gemara says, your Yetzer Hara, how do you stop the Yetzer Hara? Learn. But if that's not helping you, remind yourself of the day of death. Because after all, Yesh Din, Dayan, V'Yesh Din, we're all going to be called to account. Makes sense. So, this is Yitzchak Blazer is teaching, it's telling Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. That's what Mussar is, to remind us of where we came from, where we're going. And the Rav says that that we see here from Chazal that that there are times when the Torah is not enough and you need something else. So what did Reb Chaim reply? Just like we saw with Yisrael Salanter. If a person is sick, we prescribe castor oil for him. You have to look up what castor oil it does for you. But if you're, but if a healthy person ingests castor oil, he'll become very sick. So, in other words, if you're healthy, you don't need Mussar. You don't need to worry about the day of death and what's going to happen. If you're not healthy, then you have to take it. Like sick people need castor oil. If the evil impulse meets you and you're sound of spirit and soul, occupy yourself with Torah. That's all we need here in Volozhin. We don't need anything else. But if you're spiritually sick, fine. Go ahead and do that. And he says, we in Volozhin, thank God, are healthy in spirit and body. We are whole in our Torah. There is no need for castor oil. If the scholars of Kelm and Kovno feel compelled to drink bitter drugs, let them drink to their heart's content. But we're not coming along with them, and they shouldn't invite us. Okay, so this is, and this is famous, what the Rav said. In the next paragraph, he says, though, this criticism I just mentioned of the yeshiva, the Musar movement, the Musar yeshivas, as leading to sadness and feelings of depression. He says that was not the case in the Sabatka yeshiva under the directorship of Nosse Finkel and the Mir yeshiva under Rav Yerucham Avovitz. He says it assumed an entirely different form and approached the world perspective of the great halakhic man. There was no more fear, terror, and melancholy. Rather, there was holiness and joy of life, etc., etc. And that's absolutely correct. But then we have a problem, because two pages before, the Rav says the practicing Kovno and Sabatka. There's no Sabatka. Sabatka is only Knesset Yisrael. The yeshiva of Sabatka is Knesset Yisrael. There aren't two things. It's not like you have Sabatka, and then when the altar of Sabatka comes in, he changes it. He is Sabatka from the beginning. So I think what you have here, it's a slip of the pen of the Rav. Maybe he meant to say a different word, or maybe he wasn't aware of the fact that the altar is in Sabatka from the beginning. He says that it reached a state of maturity in Sabatka Yeshiva, the Knesset Yisrael, under the directorship of Nosse Finkel. But Nosse Finkel was there from the beginning. Unless the Rav is saying that originally when Sabatka started, it wasn't like this and it became like that. But there's no evidence of that, that there was any such change. Okay, so that's famous. That's what the Rav, he describes Rav Chaim's reply to him. But we don't have the reply of Rav Yitzchak Blazer. Rabbi Chiyo Yaakov Weinberg tells us that, yes, Rabbi Soloveitchik tells this story, and you read the story, it's like it ends with Rav Chaim Brisker winning, because Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer says we have to bring Musar in, Rav Chaim, because the Gemara says that if you can't conquer the Yetzer Hara, then remember the day of death. And Rav Yitzchak Chaim says, but we're healthy. We don't need that. Torah is enough for us. So Rabbi Weinberg says as follows. This is in, he mentions in the Sri Deish, volume 4, page 309, he cites this story that the Rav tells from Halachic Man. And everything up to what I told you so far. And but then he says, question is, what did the Rav Yitzchak Blazer reply? That the Rav doesn't tell us. He says, B'mamar, in this Maimar, no, doesn't say klum al zeh. But Rabbi Weinberg says, I remember that at a mesiba, a feast, let's say, a meal with the Sabatka students, which was in Rav Yitzchak Blazer's home on Simchas Torah, that Rav Yitzchak Blazer dealt with this claim of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And he didn't say who he was referring to. He just said, you know, this idea that you only need to do Musar if you're sick. What did Rav Yitzchak Blazer say? He says, for us, that Musar is not... it's not castor oil, that only sick people need it. But this Musar is oxygen, that everyone needs it. And when it says, I created Yetzer Hara and I created Torah, you know, to counter it, what is the Torah? Reza Bazar says that Torah is Musar. So it's not like Rav Chaim Brisker said, well, we're running Gemara, we're running Bava Kama, so therefore we don't need to worry about Musar. No, because the Gemara says if you have a problem with Yitzhara, learn Torah, and if it still doesn't work, remember the day of death. Reza Bazar says the Torah that it says you have to learn is Dafka Musar. That's what he says. And Reza Bazar added, he says that we see that people learn, you know, we can look around how people act and learn something. When someone has a pain in their head, what do? You run to the doctor, Rabbi Zabaza says. If you have a pain, let's say in your stomach, you go to the places they would go to, the Mecomos, that for health. That is, they go take the cure at the various spas. In Kissingen, he says, in Marienbad, there's a whole book, by the way, that came out about Marienbad, the spa culture. You know, all the rabbis used to go to Marienbad, the Hasidic rabbis, everyone would go to Marienbad. And so he says, Aritz Abad says, why don't they rely on what the Gemara says? The Gemara says in Erevin, here, I'll show you the Gemara. Let's see, let me pull it up for you here. Here it's in Erevin in the Daf 54. What does it say? One who feels pain in his head should engage in Torah study. One who feels pain in his throat should engage in Torah study. Okay, so Ragitza Bazar says, how come people go to Marienbad and they go to the doctor? Why don't they engage in Torah study if they have this pain? And he says the answer is that people, they're trying to find a heter. And they find it, obviously, Chazal say that, doctors are given the reshut, the ability, the permission to cure. The Torah gives it to that. And so he says, so here, when people feel physical pain, then they're not going to rely on this Gemara. They're going to rely on the other source that says you can use doctors. And by the way, we do have people of Reb Nachman and the Ramban and others who think that it's a high madrega not to use doctors, like Christian Science almost, or Jewish Science. There was such thing, Jewish Science. But when it comes to spiritual problems, Rabbi Weinberg says, then all of a sudden they want to rely on this the Gemara, which they interpret incorrectly. That's what Yitzhak Blazer says. And everyone then regards himself as a great tzaddik, that he can live. How many people are going to say that if I have a pain in my head, I'm just going to follow what the Gemara says? People will say, yes, that's only for the greatest tzaddik. He could rely on just learning Torah, but me, I have to go to the doctor. But everyone else, well, when it comes to their Yetzer Hara, then they say, oh, I don't need to go to the doctor, namely the Musar teacher. I'm just going to follow what the Gemara says. So Yitzhak Blazer says, you see the inconsistency here. When it deals with their physical health, then they don't rely on the Gemara because they say that only applies to the greatest of tzaddikim. We have to be like regular people and go to the doctor. So if they had any honesty, they would say the same thing that if when they have the spiritual problems, they wouldn't say, well, the Gemara says you can just learn Gemara. That's for the greatest of tzaddikim. They can only they can just learn Gemara, and he continues quoting Rav Yitzhak Blazer. Yitzhak Blazer says the Musar is not a snifla Torah. It's not like a part of the Torah, a branch of Torah. Ki'im haTorah ba'atzma. It is the essence of the Torah, but the Torah is divided. You have Chovos Evarim. The Chovos Avavos speaks about you have obligations that deal with our physical body, and then we have obligations, chovos levavos. Okay. What I want to do, okay, I have one more minute. I do want to call your attention to the fact that Slobodka Musar, and when with this, Gadlus Adam. The idea that, raise up the person, the person's a creation of God, always a positive outlook on life. That's the altar of Sobotka's approach. Absolutely. However, Binyamin Brown has an interesting article. It's in this volume. Let me need to get rid of this here, the picture. There's an interesting volume called Yeshivot Ubate Midrashot, Yeshivas and Ubate Midrash, edited by Emmanuel Ekes. And Binyamin Brown, Benny Brown, has an article called Gadlut Adam V'Haktanato. The raising up the greatness of man and the lowering him. Tmurot B'Shitat Musar Shel Yeshivat Slabodka. That is changes in the Shita of Musar and Slabodka. So I see it's already almost 9:25, so I'm not gonna have time to get, I'll do this at the beginning of the next class. That well, I'll summarize for you what Rav Yisrael Salant, sorry, what the altar of Slabodka's approach is. What is Gadlus Adam? And Brown shows, however, in the next generation, with Rav Yecheskel Sarna and Avraham Grudzinski, they weren't so positive They were not all in on at least how the Altar Subotica understood Gadus Adam. For the Altar Subotica, Gadus Adam is Jew and non-Jew. Every human qua human. We'll see next class about that. Then we're going to see some more about Reb Chaim and the this different yeshivas. I'll show you that what happened in Volozhin. Volozhin adopted Musar, believe it or not. Risk. Wait till you see it. And then what else do we have to do? And then we get to split number two in Sobotka. Do you know there was two great machlokas? And yes, I saw at the beginning of the note, I'll get to the questions now. We're going to deal with the Chazon Ish. Because the Chazon Ish, his approach to Musar, his critical approach, not just the Musar movement, but one of the Musar ideas. About really an Ikar, at least in one Musar school, I think, of how they view characters in Tanakh. We'll see what the Chazon Ish has to say about that. But let me take the questions here. MJ Frankel, early Maskilim were especially takers of Rosalanter after his son was appointed as professor of mathematics. Yes. not only were they taken, when his son came to town once, they put a whole ad in the news article in the newspaper that the son came to town and he's a professor to the great joy of his father. His father takes great pride in this. And Rishon Salanter had to publish an open letter. Etkus includes the letter stating that not only am I not proud of him, but I wish he would do something else. So, look, it couldn't have been easy for Rishon LeSolanter to write this, but they were trying to use the fact that Rishon LeSolanter's son did not go the religious route. Quite apart from the fact he didn't go the Torah route to become a Lamdan, he was not religious. And Rishon LeSolanter used in St. Petersburg, Yitzhak Blazer was the Rav in St. Petersburg, so he used him to try to at least, apparently the son kept kosher, but it wasn't what Rishon LeSolanter would have wanted. Now, Herb says, Solanter, Musar based on Lafin, Amaskil, adopted Benjamin Franklin's daily program to work on Mido. Yeah, we mentioned already the idea of Lefin's book from... that is based on Benjamin Franklin. And yes, the book by Leffen becomes a standard book in the Musar Yeshivas and recommended by everyone. Is it, it now? You could say they didn't know. It's true they didn't know who he was, who was a Maskil. But the fact is, from the in the Musar movement, some of them probably did know. They believed that. If someone comes up with a good idea, we can use it. And if they knew who he was, they might not have cited him by name, but they still would have used it. I mean, the greatest example I give is Rabbi Dessler. Rabbi Dessler, in his Yamim Noraim, in his Elul Sichot, in one of his Elul Sichot, he uses Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People and uses that as his Musar basis. So they were not worried about that. Wesley, the Musar teachers used Wesley, Wiesel. They thought that he had valuable things to say. So they're more open in that respect. Wasn't there something about the Chazon Ish's rockings on Musar? Yes, I'll get to that. There's two things about the Chazon Ish we'll see. First of all, in his famous Emunah Ubitachon, they publish it censored. But recently, the uncensored passages were published. But then there's the other aspect where the great machlokes that the Chazon Ish had with one Musar teacher school. He was a great admirer of the Musar yeshivas, but he had his criticisms, as we shall see. MJ Frankel, Rameir Tribbetz, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky's son-in-law, also is quite the expert in the Rav's philosophy. He published the Rav's philosophy lectures delivered in Yeshiva College in the 40s. The Rav, yes. So he published, he has a group, the Hashkafa Circle, and he published the Rav's stuff in Chakira. In fact, not only that, I benefited from it because in my forthcoming book, which is now on Amazon, but I don't know why it's on Amazon. It's still a while to come out. I cite from the lectures that Rabbi Tribbetz put into good form there in Chakira with his notes. So no, there wasn't a coherent Rav philosophy in the 40s, although the Rav did write Halachic Man, and not long after that, Halachic Mind. But the Rav published, sorry, the Rav gave lectures at Bernard Revel Graduate School on Jewish philosophy. And these were not just talking about the Rambam. These were his own ideas mixed in with that. So it's really, it's not really a graduate class in Jewish philosophy. It's the Rav giving his philosophical perspective on how to view things. So it's when we think today, you take a class in Jewish philosophy, the professor Arthur Hyman, let's say, while you is telling you what the Rambam and the Ralbag and Kreskos says, the Rav, although he would deal with all these figures, he's presenting his own philosophy. So I would say he had a philosophy. I mean, he's working it out and he's going through things. Yes, there's a few notes, people who had notes. He tells us which person had the notes, but we have a few examples. Larry Kaplan also published a volume of notes of the Rav's lectures about 5 years ago. And I had a whole class of material, but then it was already, I think Rabbi Tribbetz, the one I had, Rabbi Tribbetz hadn't published it. So, yeah. And Herb says that Rav Lessin gave a Musar lecture every year. Rav Lessin comes from Sobotka. And he was brought in by Rav Shmuel Belkin. And we spoke in a previous class why Rishuvah Yisrael Chanan did not have Musar in the beginning. And before Rav Lessin came in, they did not have it. And there was all sort a few different theories on this. They really maybe wanted to be Volozhin, but Revel comes from Tells, so I'm not sure. But yes, Rav Lessin, not only did Rav Lessin give a shiur, Rav Lessin would come into the Rav shiur, and the Rav would sit there. Well, I don't know what the Rav was thinking about, if the Rav was paying attention or not. They say he was, but he gave a lot of kavod to Rav Lessin. I told you the story in the previous class, though, about Rav Volk, and I don't need to repeat the story. If you however, I'll say it quickly, had Rav Volk and Rav Lessin, one Yom Kippur after Yom Kippur was over. But Rav Lessin's attitude was that we shouldn't just run and go eat, we're still Jews and it's still time to hear Musar. So he was speaking. He wanted to say one final word before we begin, let's say, the new year, I guess, after Yom Kippur. And Rabbi Volk yells out, really embarrasses him. Stop already. The fast is over. There are women here. They need to eat. We can't keep them, and Rav Volk was one of the Rosh Yeshiva. And yet then later, when Rav Volk needed a shidduch, this is the story that's told. Rav Volk needed a shidduch for one of his children. He went to Rav Lessin. Rav Lessin, as a true, Musar personality of the highest caliber, didn't hold a grudge, didn't, helped him out. So Frankel, MJ, you read you said you read the article on the Rav's lectures. It gave you a headache. You couldn't appreciate. Well, you can't really understand it. I don't even. I myself just skim over the parts that deal with Kantian philosophy that Tribbetz knows all about and more modern philosophy. It's not. That's not for me. I'm only interested when the Rav deals with Parshanut and with the classic philosophers. If you don't know, modern mathematics and physics and. And 20th century philosophy, and not as well as 19th and 18th century, but the most modern stuff, you can't understand the Rav. So that's why you have people like Ari Kaplan, Tribbetz, and the rest of them. But that's I stop. I think with the Renaissance when it comes to philosophy. And then you say, in your days, Rav Lessin's talks were only infrequently delivered to little interest by either students nor the Rebbe, or Sheen was being interrupted. It's interesting that when I was first told that in YU they would come to the various shiurim to give it, I mean, this is not the classic way where it would be done in the old yeshivas in the Beis Medrash, where everyone would have to listen to the Musar Shmuz. To come into the each individual shiur is quite interesting. Today they do it. in to my son's there now, and he tells me, first of all, the rebbes themselves will give a little musar shmooze to their shiur, but they'll do it in the main base medrash. They'll have a shiur. Okay, I thank you all for coming, and we look forward. I can't say how many weeks. It won't be 11 weeks or anything, but I figure four or five, maybe more, six more classes. After that, we move on to other interesting things, but we still have some important stuff at Rav Kook as well. Rav Kook had what to say about the Musar movement. He was not a complete fan of it, and yet he was such an admirer of Rishol Salanter that when Rishol Salanter died, he himself tore Kriya. And yet he never met him. But okay, but so there's a lot to do. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Okay, please God, look forward to next week. Tomorrow, as I mentioned right at the beginning, Marty Lakshin, live from Israel. He made Aliyah from Toronto, of course, a number of years ago. So we'll be giving beginning a three-part series on Slichot, then and now, sort of the modern Israeli Slichot comparing to our classical traditional Slichot. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern. And then at 1 p.m., 2 hours later, Rabbi Shulman will start a five-part series on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And tomorrow is why there's no concept of tshuva on Rosh Hashanah. I think he called it Malchut Zichronot and Iyov, I think. And then why there's no tshuva Rosh Hashanah, that's tomorrow at 1 p.m. So those are two new shiurim, two new series beginning tomorrow. So invite your friends and invite a friend. And we look forward to seeing you soon. And everybody should be well, and we should hear good news. And Laila Tov, thank you very much, everybody. Okay.
Laila Tov.
That is all.